Welcome back to the Roundtable. The International Center of the Capital Region will present a free public forum featuring a talk entitled The Role of Diplomacy in Rebuilding Security in Europe tonight from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Hudson Valley Community College Bulmer Telecommunications Center in Troy, New York. An open discussion will follow the presentation by Zachary Paikin, the Deputy Director of the Quincy Institute Better Order Project. The International Center of the Capital Region connects people across cultures to build a more inclusive and globally engaged community. The Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is an American think tank specializing in ideas to rework foreign policy. Zachary Paikin is the Deputy Director of the Quincy Institute Better Order Project, and he joins us now in advance of his talk tonight in Troy. Welcome to the Roundtable. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me in studio.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Let us discuss first, what is the Quincy Institute? What do you work on there? And then what is the Better Order Project as well? What is the focus of that particular arm of the Quincy Institute?
Well, thank you, Sarah. The Quincy Institute is a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. We are a multi-partisan organization aiming to build a grand coalition in favor of a more restrained U.S. foreign policy. That is to say, we want a U.S. foreign policy where war is the exception and peace is the norm. And so we want to privilege American engagement in the world, but we want that engagement to be more along the lines of diplomatic engagement, economic engagement. There's a role, of course, for security engagement, but military intervention is to be a last resort rather than a first resort. And the Better Order Project was launched by the Quincy Institute in the summer of 2023. And what we did there is we wanted to put together a large network of about 130 experts, but also former ministers of foreign affairs, former diplomats and ambassadors from more than 40 countries, in fact. And we did that. We brought them together in various formats over the course of more than a year, both online but also in person. And the outcome of this series of discussions and intense negotiations among all these participants was a document, a report called Towards a Better Security Order, which we published in November of last year, in which we put forward 20 different policy proposals on how to stabilize an international security order that is transitioning away from unipolarity, that is to say, away from an era in which the United States was able to set the terms and the norms and the rules of the international order alone, unilaterally, in effect. And now we're entering a world we don't know what it's going to look like. It could be more and more multipolar. It could be not 100% fully multipolar, but nonetheless, there will be a need for compromise and creativity to, bring an added modicum of stability to a very turbulent age.
The talk you're giving tonight is entitled The Role of Diplomacy in Rebuilding Security in Europe, and how does that topic fit in with what you've just told us about the goals of the Better Order Project?
Well, what we've been seeing over the past several decades, in fact, is the slow-moving deterioration and collapse of the European security order. This was owing to a number of factors, but, not least of which, the very visions that the different actors had, that the United States had, that Russia had, that Europeans had, for how to organize relations in Europe, security relations in Europe, were not identical. The Russians had a certain vision of what their role in European security questions should be. Western countries had a very different idea of what role Russia should be allowed to have. And because those disagreements were not resolved diplomatically, we ended up with all sides effectively talking past each other. And when you can't resolve your disagreements at the table, unfortunately, they get resolved in much less pleasant ways over time. And so part of what we wanted to do with this project, this was not the initial impetus, but nonetheless, we wanted to make sure that the mistakes that were made in Europe over the past several decades are not made at the global level, because we're now entering, an era, as I was mentioning before, of increasingly diffuse power and influence in the world, and the world is much more culturally diverse than Europe is alone. So the ideas that different actors and powers are going to have about how to organize global politics are also going to be quite different, and we have to find ways to understand one another's perspectives in that context.
The idea in stabilizing a post-unipolar world, if I'm understanding it correctly, is so that there won't be one superpower or two, major players or an allied force that is in charge and kind of governing the entire world, but a more communicative, equal traversement of ideas between all countries. How is your organization, the think tank, working toward making sure that happens and not that just the poll becomes a different nation, say, China?
Right, right. So, you know, the important thing to mention here is that, first of all, the process you described is happening whether we like it or not.
Right.
It's not a question of we want it to be this way or not. Power is shifting, but it's not just that material power is shifting, military power, economic power. It's not just that that's shifting. It's also influence that's shifting. Because Western countries have not always practiced what they preach, and so the influence in the rest of the world that they, you know, used to have is still significant, but not quite what it used to be. There's this perception in much of what has come to be known as the Global South that the West is not actually a reliable custodian of a fair and equitable international order. Now, you talked about, you know, China as being a possible alternative pole. My own view here, and I've got colleagues at the Quincy Institute who work full-time on China and our East Asia program, but my own view, and I'm sure that it's one that they share as well, is that China does not want to play the role that the United States currently, you know, has played for the past several decades. And it is not capable of playing that role either. Because if you look at the balance of power in Asia alone, you've got so many other important powers. You've got Japan, you've got, you know, the Southeast Asian countries in ASEAN, you've got South Korea, you've got India as well, you've got Australia, and of course you still have the United States, which is a hugely important naval power. And so if you put all of that together, and there's Russia, of course, which is also present in Northeast Asia, and so you put all of that together, and it becomes clear that China will have difficulty exerting fully fledged domination over its own region, to say nothing of the entire world. So I don't think that's really what China's interested in doing. Nonetheless, China does have core interests. And so if we do not find ways to avoid conflict with China in ways that allows us to respect one another's core interests, we're going to be running into problems here. So I think that the middle ground position here is where we need to be focused on. Not this, you know, exaggerated fear of China possibly dominating the world, but that doesn't mean that we can disregard, you know, what China's core interests are either. We need to find a happy middle.
The people who participated in the report that your organization released last November, how were they selected to participate, and what did their participation include?
Well, the most important thing is we wanted to make sure that we had people who represented the political mainstream in the countries that they were coming from. Because what we wanted to forge through this report that we published was, and that they all endorsed, by the way, and that most of them added their names to, is a genuine global compromise. We wanted it to be a genuine global compromise. So it wouldn't be helpful to get, you know, an opposition figure from a given country, for example. We wanted people who were well plugged in their own capitals, could represent the dominant perspective in their capitals, and then could transmit the ideas that we all agreed on as a global group, to decision makers in their respective capitals. And so I think we succeeded in that very well. And of course, a lot of the ideas that we put forward are compromises. And so decision makers in these different capitals, whether it's in China or in Russia or in the United States, they weren't always happy with what, you know, these participants, signed up to. But there was so much, political will in our group to reach a compromise. There was so much ownership that these participants really took in the process. And that made us so, thrilled and relieved and excited that, you know, everyone, it doesn't matter whether you're from the West or from the East or from the North or from the South, everyone realizes there's something wrong right now. And that, you know, lecturing at each other, as we've seen countries do for the past several years or decades, is not really a path to peace. Citing principles at one another. You know, we all have principles that we like to cite at one another. But that's not a pathway to peace either. That's not genuine diplomacy. That's just posturing for the rest of the world and trying to win over the rest of the world. And that's not good for anyone. It's not a winning strategy for the Americans or the Chinese or the Russians. It might be a short-term winning strategy, but over the long term, that's not going to secure, a stable international order based on agreed-upon principles, agreed-upon cooperative mechanisms and institutions that can deliver benefits for everyone. And that should ultimately be a goal if we want America to be secure. And so we saw our participants play a really important and ongoing active role over the course of a year, negotiating with each other in online formats, and then we brought them all together for two big in-person conferences. The core group, not all 130, but a core of 40 or so, of the most senior figures that we had in our group, we brought them together in Istanbul, for two conferences to hammer out some of the final details, and we got an agreement over the finish line. And we did not necessarily assume at the beginning of this project that we'd be able to do that because of all the different perspectives that exist in today's world. But thankfully, these guys showed that a compromise is possible, and so we hope that decision makers and capitals will also realize that if they find the political will, compromise is possible as well.
We, of course, don't have time this morning to go over all of the elements of the report, but it is available online to read at your website. And I will give that URL at the end of the segment. But could you pick a few of them to tell us about, a few of the maybe most surprising or interesting to you, top of mind solutions, proposals that the group agreed on and put in the report?
Mm-hmm. Well, so right at the beginning of the report, the issue that we touch on is reform of the UN Security Council, which is obviously hugely important because this is a central body that is responsible for upholding international law, but also international peace and security. And you've got so many different countries that have very different ideas about how it should be structured. Right now, you've got five permanent members: the United States, Russia, China, the UK, and France, who are the victors of World War II. But the fact is, you know, there are a lot of countries in the world today who think that that was 80 years ago, and the purpose of the United Nations has evolved a great deal since then, and it is not just about the victors of World War II coming together and making decisions on behalf of everybody else. And they want to see a more representative Security Council and a more effective Security Council. But there are so many different perspectives on this. There are countries at the UN who are worried that, you know, if you expand the number of permanent members to reflect the fact that we're entering a more and more multipolar world, then you're going to give the veto to new permanent members possibly, and then they're worried that, you know, they might abuse those veto privileges and that you'll see even more impunity for people, for countries that violate international law. So there's that concern. But of course, you know, at the same time, there are rising powers like India and others who do want a status in the international order that they think is commensurate with their rising power. And so how do you get all these countries to agree and reach a requisite 2/3 of all UN member states to endorse a change to the UN Charter, to change the composition of the Council? It's not easy, but we did manage to get a formula that everyone agreed on, which we're thrilled about.
Do you have it top of mind? Do you know the formula?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we expand the permanent membership by three. We've decided to add one seat for Africa, one seat for Asia, and one seat for Latin America and the Caribbean. Of course, Africa is demanding two permanent seats, and we're very much open to that idea as well. But we, you know, propose this to some extent as an interim reform, because we also propose that there should be automatic UN Charter reviews every 24 years in our proposal. Mm-hmm. And we propose, quite interestingly, that these three new permanent members should be elected by the General Assembly rather than just selected, based on their power. And then we also, on top of that, are in favor of creating a new pool of semi-permanent members who would be elected. There'd be 20 countries in this pool, and they would rotate on and off the council, five at a time. So they would get to serve automatically for two out of every 8 years. And the idea there is to compensate those countries that do not get elected to a permanent seat, who are currently an obstacle to the reform of the council, because they're saying, well, why not me? If this country gets a permanent seat, how come I don't get a permanent seat? But the benefit of having this pool of 20 semi-permanent members is that the smaller countries would no longer have to compete against them for the existing elected 10 seats. And so we think our proposal there is a win-win-win, that bigger countries, middle-sized countries, and smaller countries can all get behind.
Zachary Pakin is the deputy director of the Quincy Institute Better Order Project. He's speaking tonight at the Hudson Valley Community College in an event presented by the International Center of the Capital Region. So, reworking the UN Security Council, what other elements came forth in the report?
Well, I mean, quite a bit. We've got seven policy variables overall. So we also have norms about how to tighten norms surrounding the use of force, so making countries less cavalier in their resort to the use of force. Policies as well to advance the nuclear nonproliferation and arms control agenda, so to avert nuclear war. Also tightening norms around the use of economic sanctions and their abuse, particularly in the form of secondary sanctions, which basically means, you know, that you're prohibiting other countries with doing business with a targeted country rather than just your own country, which is in effect a siege and has major humanitarian implications. And so we're drawing on ideas from international humanitarian law, but also from arms control regimes on how to limit sanctions and limit the economic damage, for much of the rest of the world. And on top of that, we have ideas about climate, peace and security, artificial intelligence, and last but certainly not least, regional security in those regions that are currently experiencing hot wars. So in the Middle East and in Europe, what sort of new regional security arrangements can help to avoid conflict in the future?
I have a question about the influence and implementation. How does the Quincy Institute endeavor to get this in front of lawmakers and political leaders to consider it, to possibly approve it, to work with you on it? Where does it become not something that sounds fantastic on paper and a possibly a real thing in the world.
Yeah, well, look, we've been pushing really hard with the help of our 130-plus member network to connect us with decision-makers in capitals around the world, and that's what we've been doing. We've been traveling around the world, meeting with diplomats, with politicians, with decision-makers to gauge their interest in specific support, in specific issues, rather. In some cases, you've got one country that's really interested in one of our research areas and one of our proposals, but maybe not in the other ones, but they might want to be a champion in this one area. And so on UN Security Council reform, we've been very privileged, to meet with several, ambassadors, permanent representatives, deputy permanent representatives, expert-level diplomats in New York City, around the United Nations. I'll be giving a speech in New York City actually tomorrow, at which there will be 25 permanent representatives, that is to say ambassadors, and 25 more deputy permanent representatives present. More than 100 people are going to be in the room in total to outline these ideas for Security Council reform. And we hope that those ideas, will get picked up, if not immediately, then over time, because everyone's still got their ingrained positions on this issue. But as negotiations continue and eventually hit a brick wall, but nonetheless, the international community realizes that reform is needed if the UN is to remain, a relevant actor and body for, resolving and addressing major global disputes. We hope that, these actors will remember that, hey, the Quincy Institute, that guy from the Quincy Institute came by a couple of years ago and gave us these ideas in his report. I've got those ideas now in my back pocket, and maybe this is a way where we can pull those ideas out of the pocket and, break a deadlock in given negotiations at a given time. So, this takes a lot of time, and this is a long-term project, but we've been really, really grateful for the very interesting and significant degree of uptake we've had on many of these proposals in several different capitals so far.
Is the speech you're giving tomorrow different from the talk you're giving tonight, or is tonight a practice?
No, they're two different speeches.
Totally different speeches.
So my background is in European security issues, so that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight. But tomorrow in New York City, I'm going to be talking about the reform of the UN Security Council.
How did you find your way into this line of work and your areas of expertise?
I don't know how much time we've got, but...
A few minutes.
Okay. Well, I did my PhD in international relations in the UK, and I started off wanting to research the positions of Russia and China on the responsibility to protect doctrine, which is a doctrine aimed to prevent mass atrocities against civilians, and to evaluate, therefore, how this doctrine, the R2P doctrine, would evolve as the world became more and more multipolar. But the more I started doing the research, the more I realized that this was ultimately about Russian and Chinese conceptions of sovereignty, right? How they see, when it's legitimate to put sovereignty aside or not. And therefore, sovereignty, the principle of sovereignty being such an important pillar of international order more generally, it got me particularly interested in looking at those two powers' perspectives on the international order and what the nuances are of their perspectives on it. And so I finished my PhD back in 2020, tried to get a job in academia. Unfortunately, there are few jobs in academia, and managed to get a job in the think tank world instead. And so I've been working in the policy world for the past 5 years, first in Brussels, then in Geneva, now with the Quincy Institute in Washington, just working on issues pertaining to EU foreign policy at first, and then eventually broader European security issues, and bringing diplomats together for various dialogue formats to try to give them a safe space for dialogue. And then most recently with the Quincy Institute, something quite similar, except on a grander scale rather than just related to European security issues.
The International Center of the Capital Region presentation that you're giving tonight, as we mentioned, is the role of diplomacy in rebuilding security in Europe. What are some of the main elements of the talk that you will give tonight? Obviously, don't give it all away. We want people to head over to this free public forum in Troy.
Right, right. Well, I mean, as I was mentioning, in the post-Cold War European security order, you had a series of actors who were mostly talking at each other rather than genuinely talking to each other. And the reciprocal citation of principles is not a pathway to peace and security in Europe. And so I'm going to be talking about the ways in which the institutions that were designed to manage security in Europe in the post-Cold War era, and I include in that NATO and the European Union, but also the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, ultimately the mixture between these institutions proved insufficient in providing Russia with a position in the European Security Order that it felt would be commensurate with its status, rightly or wrongly, but one way or another they felt aggrieved, and it ultimately, you know, led us on this pathway towards tit-for-tat escalation in which there were off-ramps, but ultimately all actors chose not to take advantage of them. So whether it's the institutions, whether it's the broader principles that were enshrined in those institutions, we couldn't necessarily agree on what those were. And so going forward, those tensions between those principles are going to remain. We're just going to have to find ways to adjudicate them a little bit better. So I'm not suggesting that we're going to have a rosy relationship with Russia anytime soon. But, you know, if we can find some kind of way for private, you know, less public-facing diplomacy in which, you know, certain tensions between principles can be discussed without trying to get headlines, you know, that would be helpful, at least to avert the worst case outcomes.
Are the off-ramps that you mentioned that were missed or not taken available to be rebuilt as current off-ramps, or is the process to get out of the situation we're now a different and new plan than missed off-ramps from the past?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. And the reality is that the worse the conflict between Russia and the West gets, the harder it is to identify off-ramps. The more the different positions between the parties become really entrenched and harder to reconcile. And so, you know, I think it's pretty clear to me, and the Russians have communicated this, you know, repeatedly as well. And it seems as if President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, has internalized this as well. What the Russians are interested in is a broader renegotiation of the European security order and a political settlement to the Ukrainian question, as opposed to just what the Trump administration has been pursuing so far, which is, you know, making our way to just a ceasefire. Just let's stop shooting at each other, and then we'll deal with all these issues later. Now, you know, chicken or the egg, this is a hard thing to figure out. But at the very least, there needs to be some kind of agreement on the political principles and the issues that we're going to be discussing over the coming months and years. We're not going to resolve all of this overnight. But there needs to be an agenda, and there needs to be a clear communication to Moscow of the things that we're prepared to discuss. And only then, you know, will we undergo you know, a gradual process of trust building in which a ceasefire will be one step of the process, and agreeing on the modalities of a ceasefire, et cetera, which is, you know, a very heavy lift in and of itself. But nonetheless, this process of trust building is going to take a long time. Some of these processes, I mean, whether it's, you know, rebuilding arms control in Europe or other issues, could well take years. And, you know, I think it's an open question whether or not the Trump administration has the attention span, you know, and the real focus to see through that complex set of issues along different negotiation tracks all at the same time.
Or hard to see if the Trump administration is even interested in what you are proposing.
Well, indeed, yeah. I mean, the impression that...
And other leadership in other nations as well.
Right? Sure. I mean, the impression that we have so far from the Trump administration is that they're interested in a quick ceasefire because, you know, the midterms are already next year and, you know, Trump has a lot of things that he wants to address during his presidency, presumably, assuming this is going to be his last term in office. Well, I guess we don't know that for a fact, but...
I don't know that he assumes that.
Right. So, you know, I think he wants a quick resolution to the conflict as a result. The problem is these issues are very complicated. For the reason that I mentioned. I mean, that, you know, these disagreements between Russia and the West have been accumulating for so long. And there are so many actors in the process that have the ability to frustrate this process. You know, there's the Americans, there's the Europeans, who are 27 different countries plus the United Kingdom. You've got the Ukrainians, you've got the Russians. There are different stakeholders in this process. And it's very possible to throw a spanner in the works. We've seen the Europeans do that already. You know, they've mentioned that they're not prepared to entertain sanctions relief to Russia, even, you know, partial sanctions relief in exchange for, you know, a gradual, you know, moves towards a ceasefire in Ukraine. So, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, we're going to have a very difficult process here in which we have to find ways to, you know, grant legitimacy to the security fears and perceptions of so many different actors who have very different, you know, security fears and perceptions. And unfortunately, for the past several years and decades, we've been spending our time dismissing the fears and perceptions of one another. You know, we've told the Russians, for example, that you have no reason to be concerned about NATO expansion because, you know, NATO expansion isn't directed against anybody. It's just about ensuring peace and security and cooperation and democracy and capitalism in Europe, and you shouldn't see it as a threat at all. And the Russians have been saying to Poland and the Baltics and others, you know, you guys are just a bunch of Russophobes and you have no reason to be afraid of us. And so, you know, dismissing one another's security concerns is not a pathway to peace either. But I think we have to start from the premise that that everyone's security, you know, fears and perceptions are legitimate. And, you know, once we acknowledge that, we can, you know, begin the trust building process in earnest.
Zachary Pakin is the deputy director of the Quincy Institute Better Order Project. The International Center of the Capital Region presents Zachary Pakin giving a talk tonight, The Role of Diplomacy in Rebuilding Security in Europe. That's from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Hudson Valley Community College Bulmer Telecommunications Center in Troy, New York. For more information, you can visit ICCRAlbany.org. And that link and links to the Quincy Institute and the Better Order Project will be posted along with this interview on our website, WAMC.org. Zach, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.